But what I think is really interesting, and something that we don't talk about as writers, is what do we do with like periods of absence away from our work and away from our practice? How do we get back there?
What did Nam say?
We had Namely on the show, and Nam,
he
had a great answer, which is he said, he's in the gathering phase.
Yeah. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Sad Me of the Past, where we invite an established writer to revisit a piece they wrote in their tender years. That piece may fill them with affection, regret, nostalgia, embarrassment, relief, delight, anguish, all of the above, or something else entirely. Every infant must take those early, brave, awkward steps when learning to walk. We writers must make our own early, brave, awkward efforts as we set out to master our craft. So let's travel back to that ancient time when we were bursting with hubris or scared to death, drunk with language or paralyzed by it, determined to become a writer or terrified that we didn't have the stuff. I'll show them, we thought. But what did we show, really, and to whom? Hi, everybody. Welcome to Sad Me of the Past. I'm Stephen Lovely, director of the Iowa Young Writers Studio.
And I'm Lauren Haldeman, the senior editor at the Writing University.
And I'm Danny Colacci, executive director of the Office of Writing and Communication here at the University of Iowa. And listeners, if you can believe it, today marks the start of season 3 of Sad Me of the Past. And what better way to show the breadth and reach of our show than to start off with a guest from all the way across the pond, a writer whose own range is so vast and whose work is so good. We honestly just feel honored to have her with us in the studio today. Of course, I'm talking about the one and only Naomi Wood. Naomi Wood is the best-selling author of The Godless Boys, Mrs. Hemingway, The Hiding Game, and the stunning short story collection This Is Why We Can't Have Nice Things. Her books have won a Gerwood Award, the British Library Hay Festival Prize, and has been shortlisted for the Walter Scott Prize, the Dylan Thomas Prize, and the Historical Writer's Golden Crown. Wood was recognized with the BBC's National Short Story Prize in 2023 and has also won the Desperate Literature Tbilisi Prize and has been shortlisted for the Manchester Fiction Prize, the Galley Beggars Press Prize, and the Society of Authors Prize. She is an associate professor of creative writing at the University of East Anglia, the flagship and premier creative writing program in the UK. Last week, when teaching a group of eager young first-year students on campus, we had a conversation about why we write. The students journaled, and by the time we came together to discuss our responses, they eagerly began shouting what ended up being many of the same ideas. To understand ourselves and the world around us, to express ourselves, to inform others, to inspire thoughts and, gasp, for fun and escape. When reading the work of Naomi Wood, one immediately feels these same concepts pulling through her sentences and paragraphs. Through sharp prose, imaginative and astute world building, and senses of humanistic joy I, for one, find deeply compelling, Wood's work speaks not only to an audience by breathing life onto the page, but it also speaks through them, often expressing intimate, taboo, curious, personal, and of-the-body topics that feel like they have suddenly given voice to the great silent and inquisitive narratives many of us carry with us, but aren't always able to convey. From reimagined alternative realities in her novel, The Godless Boys, to the hyper-real and really fascinating exploration of motherhood, female bodies, and gender dynamics at play in the workplace, the home, and, well, everywhere that she explores in her new collection of stories, Naomi Wood is a writer who knows why they write, knows how to write, and shows us the power of what reading that writing can do. It can inform and give voice. It can make us think and bring us joy. It can and does change lives. Listeners, join me in welcoming, all the way from East Anglia, Naomi Wood.
Yay!
Welcome, Naomi! Welcome to the pod.
Yes, welcome. We're so glad to have you here. You're visiting Iowa City through both the English department and the IWP this week. And I'll explain a little bit of what we're doing here. Sad Me of the Past is a way to show new writers and writers who are just starting out that we all start from the same place. No one's born a best-selling novelist. And I remember when I was a new writer, I would have loved to see some of my heroes' early work. Mm. And so that's sort of the idea. We go through basically history of how you began writing, and then we're going to hear some of your early pieces, which I can see right now on the table, written in fourth grade handwriting.
Fourth grade is how old I'm trying to translate it into UK. It's I was 7 or 8, I think. Yes, yes. Okay. Yeah, 1991, my mum's put on the top of the...
Do you remember when you first started writing or got interested in writing? You know, was it at about this time at the age of 7 or 8, or had you been writing? How far back does that kind of journey go?
I think it goes back earlier because I wrote a book...
Yeah. A book?
Yeah, you did.
Wait, there's a book?
Yeah.
I called it a novel.
Nice. Well,
about a group of eggs. They were a family, and they lived under the stairs. I think maybe it had 16 pages, and
wow.
It was illustrated. So
perfect.
Me calling it a novel is outlandish, to say the least. But I was very proud of that, and I sort of stapled it together, and it had, you know, a front cover and a back cover and
an
ISBN.
Just from your basic description of it, was it a sad story?
No,
oh,
it wasn't.
Okay.
And I remember when
good.
I was writing as a child, everybody ended up at home with a cup of cocoa.
Oh, good.
I think maybe
wow.
I was reading Enid Blyton. And but what's interesting is that we never drank cocoa. We had hot chocolate. You know, cocoa is actually quite bitter. So obviously I'd pulled this image from books that I was reading. And cocoa was the full stop, the period to end the story.
You were already writing a different reality into existence.
Yeah, but also not really realizing it, I suppose,
yeah.
Because, I was pulling in this, like, imagined thing, which I had never tasted.
Mm-hmm. And you were writing from the point of view of eggs, so...
Yeah, yeah.
Psychic leap there.
And eggs don't have mouths.
Well, they definitely had faces. I remember the front cover, and they were a very sweet family. I think they went to the seaside. And there was no cracking and no
were they hard boiled?
Yes,
yeah,
they were entirely formed.
Okay. Makes me feel a lot better about
that. There's a Japanese show called Gudetama. I don't know.
Oh,
if
yes.
Got kids. Yeah. And no, but these eggs are very whole and undamaged and untraumatized by the world.
Naomi, it's interesting. Many of our guests have brought up at some point in their lives that they wrote this book and they stapled it. It's just interesting to see a kind of uniformity across so many writers that at some point early in their lives, they started to think about not only what their words could do, but how it could like exist in the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And a lot of them also... came from houses and homes and situations where like reading was encouraged, and that's how they started to see that. So you mentioned before some of the books you were reading prior to like starting the writing. Do you remember, was your home a home where like books were always there? Were you just like a really avid reader, or was that something that only came later?
Yeah, I think I was just from one of those very sort of middle class backgrounds where there were lots of books in the house, and it was the 80s, so there was only sort of 4 channels on the TV, and it only started at 3 o'clock after you got home from school. So there wasn't a huge amount of TV, and we did read a lot. I think I read more than my kids do now. So, there were always books in the house, and my parents read a lot. My parents both in education, so maybe that there was a sort of organic... interest in reading and my parents are both still avid readers, so it was sort of in the atmosphere.
Do you remember what you liked to read? Did you have any favorite sort of early books or
let me
remember?
I'm also trying to break through the sort of sonic barrier
jet
lag.
Right,
Roald Dahl, I think, was a really boring cliche answer, but he was around for the whole my childhood. And then I really got into Judith Kerr. I think maybe that was slightly later on, but when Hitler Stole Pink Rabbit, all of those books. I mean, you start with when the tiger that came to tea, obviously, and then I was into, I did quite like a World War II sort of child victims running through Europe trying to find escape was like something fascinating to me.
Yeah.
Something I talked about with my grandparents as well, I think.
We had a series here called The Boxcar Children that I was obsessed with, and it was a group of orphans living in a boxcar outside of a town, and I was obsessed.
Yeah.
And I remember my first stories that I was writing, everyone was an orphan.
Yeah.
You know, and so I can imagine the same too, where you're dipping into that history, but it's from like this pack of children's perspective.
I think there's also a fascination with like total trauma that as someone who's quite cushioned, like I had a nice childhood, like to be unhoused and unparented and exposed to the sort of raw, you know, the pulse of things like, with the war in Europe, it's just like, wow, this actually happened to these kids. And I was fascinated by the excitement and the sorrow and the big emotions rather than like my smaller feelings, like with the eggs under the stairs.
It's like practice feeling in this weird way. Yeah,
it's also interesting to have been, and so we should also clarify, so where, when you were growing up, so where were you? I know that you had moved at a certain point, but at this age, maybe when you were starting to write, where were you living?
Yeah, so I was born in Liverpool, and then I grew up in York, so in the north of England, and then we lived in a suburb outside of York, which is very like lovely, beautiful medieval city in the north. But I lived in a sort of pretty working class suburb of York. And then 1992, I moved to Hong Kong and was there for, so I spent half my childhood in York and then half my childhood in East Asia.
Okay. Well, I was thinking about how, so I grew up in the Midwest, which is where we are now. But I remember reading in history, we'd read about the Civil War. And even though it was part of where I was, we didn't have like Civil War battlefield. So it still felt like distanced. It must have been in some way different to grow up hearing about the war, but also being able to move around a country that was directly impacted by it, to see, if not the the sort of reaction to it in terms of things being crumbled and built, but like the energy of those places that had dealt with it head on.
Yeah, and also just talking to my grandparents about it, they were all involved. And my mum's mum lived in Scotland, and she was in the land army, so she was growing food for the troops. And then her husband, she wasn't married to him, but he was in a prisoner of war camp in Changi in Singapore, and my dad's dad was a nurse in the Red Cross. So we recently found out that my great-grandfather had died in the First World War, and then we found his grave in France. So, like, all of this is mad. I don't know why, but it feels mad that you're in this dynastic lineage of a lot of trauma and bloodshed, and everything so calm and peaceful and prosperous right now, as telling my kids about their grandparents and showing them some photos of them in their war uniforms, and to them it's just like totally alien.
There's like a dissonance there, or an echo. I grew up outside DC, so I was surrounded by Civil War battlefields and monuments. That was over 100 years ago, about 150 years ago, whereas World War I and II were much closer in time to your childhood, you know? Yeah. It's got a, it is a strange thing to walk through a world knowing that there's kind of like energetic palimpsest or layering, you know? And I can't imagine like being a kid and trying to interpret that layering.
Yeah, but sort of also difficult or challenging, because what's there is not so much an energy as a an absence.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, because I feel like both my parents were really affected by their parents non-talking.
Ah, yeah.
So it was just like everything got rerouted, and all of that energy or that non-speaking or that, you know, especially with my mum's dad, who'd been, he managed to survive the prisoner of war camp for like 4 years.
Wow.
But then came back to Scotland and then just didn't talk to them about it. Of course, like didn't talk to his kids. And then it's like, what does my mum carry from that, and my uncles? And so energy feels like kind of the wrong word for it, because it was a sort of like stilled tension, which I know is a kind of energy, but like it was a sort of thing I think that like both my parents are still trying to navigate and negotiate.
Do you feel like you were tasked somehow to, through writing, through creativity, to bring those stories or just that those feelings to the forefront?
I've never written about it, probably my family still doesn't talk about of this stuff.
I was gonna ask the same question though. Do you feel like, I mean, maybe it's too simple, but do you feel like that sort of that palpable silence or absence, you know, maybe at an early age, in some way inspired you to be more communicative or to be more explorative or?
I don't know. That's such an interesting question. I mean, my parents were quite communicative with me. They were quite voluble. And I'm sure my dad became a psychologist. He became an educational psychologist in order to gain some legibility in his own feelings and to understand or to start to articulate a narrative about his own family. I don't know where the impulse to write came from, apart from the fact that it helped me understand the world.
Yeah.
And that was very soothing to me to try and put words to internal feeling. And I think the one engine that always keeps me going in writing is confusion. Like, I'm constantly confused.
That's so good.
Why do people act the way they do? You know, I'm like, I would never do what you just did. Like, but to you, that's perfectly reasonable and logical.
It's a great starting point.
And that actually leads into something I've been thinking about. So you mentioned, so you growing up in York and Liverpool, right? A couple of these different places. And then you moved pretty far away.
Yeah.
At the time that you're writing and then you move, did you continue to write? Did your writing expand by the time you moved to East Asia? Like, did you find that the writing there became a way for you to understand the experiences you were going through? Did the writing stop at any point?
Yeah, I think it ebbed away. So I moved and it didn't in any way feel traumatic. I think it was harder for my older sister, but I was 9. So I was sort of like ripe and easy and had an easy time transitioning. I had a very, very strong Yorkshire accent, which I don't know, to American listeners, it might be something like the farmer and babe. I had like a broad Yorkshire accent. And then when I moved there, everybody was like, what are you saying? So I changed my accent really quickly and it became quite transatlantic because there were Americans and Canadians and Australians and Brits out there. And then when I came back to university in England, I suddenly went very posh because I had to change my accent again. So there is a degree of like ventriloquizing, which I became very used to in terms of expressing myself. So I think it ebbed away when I went out there. And then, you know, maybe I was a little bit embarrassed that I was into writing because as a teenager, it's something maybe a bit nerdy or a bit geeky. And then I think I got more into it, started writing poetry.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
And then I got really into sort of writing stories. And it became evident to my I had a really encouraging English teacher, you know, I think when you, Mr. Tucker, and he just really encouraged me to write. And I was maybe a bit embarrassed about it as a hobby, but I also, you know, I always enjoyed it. So it went through ebbs and flows for sure, that my degree of like shame about it came and went.
On almost every one of these interviews, this podcast has somehow become this celebration of English teachers.
Yeah.
everyone, you know, and I love that it just happens in so many of our stories where one person really
there's always a person.
Yeah, changes the trajectory of our lives, and often it's an English teacher.
Mm-hmm. Or sometimes another writer who just someone will have contact with, and you'll realize it's being a writer is something you can do.
In Hong Kong, we had no contact with sort of Anglophone writers. There really wasn't any of that. So that was only when I came back to England that we were talking, Danny, before about like how cool it is when you come to Iowa that you can meet writers all the time. And that would have been something completely alien to me at school. Like, it wasn't part of my culture. Like, books were at home, but you weren't really meant to participate in the arts. You were just meant to observe and enjoy.
Right.
Do you remember a moment when you realized, or a time period where you realized, oh, that being a writer could be a thing, a doable thing?
I think I was somewhat confused about what I wanted to do professionally when I was a teenager. I thought maybe I might go into the law, or I knew probably that was going to involve languages or the humanities. It was, I think, much later that I decided that I wanted to write when I worked After my job my first job at university, I worked in a publishing house and did that for 2 years. And I was like, why aren't I satisfied? And it's because I was working with the mechanics of the book, but I wasn't. And then at that point, I thought, okay, I'm either going to become an academic or a writer because I want to write the books, not make the books.
Well, I think we should come back to exactly that moment. But before we do, I think we should maybe invite you to read your piece.
Oh, yes.
And maybe you could just tell us a little bit about, if you remember, like where you were, what prompted the piece.
You writing in school?
Did you write in school? Did you write in a closet, in your bedroom?
When my mom sent me this piece, I was furnished with a new memory of having written it. And I was really confused by my mum growing up because, as I said, we grew up in this really like working class part of Yorkshire. But we were the poshest family, and I knew that we had this, we had a bigger house than everyone else, and that confused me too. And I remember my mum didn't look like any of the other mums at school. And I was like, why does she have armpit hair?
like, she's a hippie.
I don't think she was a hippie. I think she was just a feminist, nice. Right? So she had short hair and she had armpit hair. And all of the other mums at school were really pretty. And I was really into that. I was like, oh, I love pretty. I was like really lusting hard after the pretty mums. And they all had like, I guess, like a side pole, like a side ponytail. Yeah. And like crimped hair. And they were in their 20s.
Yeah.
And I just was like, I love those women. And my mom is not like that.
Confusion.
So I was like really confused because I love my mom so much, but I really wanted her to look like those moms because those moms were feminine in a way that society understood and the way that I understood. So I think this piece comes out of some of that confusion, and it's like it speaks to love, but also the fact that I wanted her to be someone else.
Yeah. And again, remind the listeners, you were how old, do you think, when you wrote this?
So 1991, I was seven or eight.
Whoa.
Yeah. And I have a keen understanding of my own bank account.
Yes, I can't wait to hear it.
Right.
Okay, so my mum is very special to me. But she doesn't do all the things like tidy my bedroom and buy me sweets. Candy. But she is still nice. If she changed, it just wouldn't be her. She doesn't buy me sweets or toys.
Man, really hung up.
little repeat there. I have got to pay for my own. How I do this is I have £1.50 a week. I think that's quite a lot in 1991. It's like $2.
Yeah.
That's my pocket money. Do I do the spellings? Do I do the phonetic reading?
Please,
okay, pocket.
Please.
This is my pocket money. and in Mooneyton, £16. But in the bank, I have £58 that I have saved up on my own. See, I carry the scarcity mentality with me.
So maybe you were writing about the generational trauma all the time.
I mean, it's like really coming through.
You wanted to be an accountant.
Yeah. Okay. Then I have £310. I'm really curious about where this money went. I feel like my parents might have stolen this off me. That my granddad gave me when he died, full stop, out of his will, full stop. When I get home, I get home. I say hi and say, how was your day? My mum has to go all the way to Leeds, which is near where we used to live. She teaches grown-ups. I think she works at the tech, or it might be in the poly, I think. My mum buys me clothes mostly buys them from Marks and Spencer's or Tammy Girl. So really full, rich portrait of my mum and not me.
Wait, is that the end?
Yeah. That's the end.
Yeah. Yeah. I love it. Yeah. No, you are figuring stuff out. Look at that. It's like you started writing about your mom, but you are trying to figure out what an adult is and what an adult does.
But also why I was so different to everyone else.
Right.
Like, everybody else seems to get bought sweets. And
right.
Mm-hmm. They their mums tidy their bedrooms, like these poor women.
Yeah.
And my mum's some enfranchised, liberated woman who's going to the tech or the poly, and I'm like, God, I wish she was. I wish she was chained to the sink
right,
again.
Right, right.
Making me apple pie when I got home.
Married to a bricklayer.
Yeah.
What's fascinating though is you never announce in that story that you want it to change.
Right.
I mean, even at the very beginning, you say, "My mom is very important to me," and then you say, "She doesn't buy me sweets." I do that on my own. And how I do that, you're like empowering yourself at that age, but you never are saying the thing that it also seems like maybe you're trying to point out in this conversation, which is that you were curious about her and maybe you envied these other women. That doesn't come across. Like,
no, there's no condescension.
Yeah,
there's no.
It feels like you are actually working out just how valuable that is to you.
But I think there's something even more complicated going on in that I can detect the shadow of my worry that she's going to read it.
Oh.
Talk more
yes.
about that.
We want to hear
so
about
that. So when I say she is still nice, if she changed it, just wouldn't be her. It's like I think I'm talking to her or I'm... I think there was a secret fantasy that she would change
oh.
and become the sexy ladies at the gates.
Yeah. Right, yeah. Do you think you were, I mean...
You already had an audience, basically.
Yeah, I think it just speaks to some confusion that I think I felt she was going to read it. And
yeah.
so I think I detect some carefulness
yeah.
in how I'm phrasing things.
That's interesting because the way I heard that was you sort of trying to explain to yourself sort of the negative consequences of the change that you kind of hope for. Like if she does change, like I would like her to, well, she wouldn't be herself. So there's something confusing about that too.
Yeah.
Something that would be confusing.
But also I understand
but,
now
yeah.
that I'm a mother that
yes.
like
yeah, yeah.
the idea or fantasy of a stay-at-home mom, like... I can understand. Like, I'm here. I'm in America. I'm not with my children. They're with the babysitter right now. So I get that they would be like, wouldn't it be nice if mum wasn't in Iowa right now? And I'm like,
yeah.
Rachel Yoda said yesterday with Sharon Van Etten in conversation, like, mother needs to feed herself too. And I was like, yeah, mummy is feeding herself right now. So in some ways, it's really interesting to think about children as harboring sort of regressive fantasies about mummy and daddy,
right.
that everything would be nice and very clear binaries of production or industry.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Do you think you're also aware of, not to bring my own stuff into this, but I
we always do.
Thinking
here comes Danny's
therapy
stuff.
For us.
My dad is not from the States and, you know, spoke a different language and grew up in a different country. And I remember very similarly wishing in some ways like, oh, man, I wish my dad didn't have that accent.
Wouldn't
or
it be great?
I wish that we didn't have this strange food in our fridge. And part of what that made me do was also like I picked up on, yes, the generational trauma, but also like the things that I don't think I realized until way later that I was realizing like he might have been having some emotional reaction. It's just like
yeah.
I wonder if part of this also is like you picking up on how your mom may have felt anyway about going in and seeing those women and recognizing even in her own confidence. Maybe the mom realizing, well, I look different, and wondering if that's projected onto you. It's an interesting model to start thinking about how what you're picking up on might also have been something your mom was thinking about.
100%,
yeah.
And like, you know, she trained social workers, so that's where she was going. When the poly or the tech is like a sort of a place that's not quite a university, and she was always just this, like this feminist figure who has bequeathed me so much in terms of my own work ethic and my really generous ability to like make my children independent of me. Or, you know, I'm fully cognizant of the gift that she has given me because I toddled them off to nursery at 3 months very, very easily. And I think it does give you, or she gave me a real strong sense of like, what it means to feed yourself as well as your children, and that both are possible. But what I think is just so sweet in this piece is that, like, the reductive need in the child fit, just like you were saying, I want everything to be the same. Yeah. I want to be the same as everyone else. And, yeah. I, you know, and my mum somehow was an outlier in the context, less so when we moved, we moved to Hong Kong, because maybe we're just surrounded by more women who were working.
It's fascinating to me, too, that this isn't a diary entry. And at this age, you already understood the difference between internal writing for yourself and writing that may have a reader and may have a specific reader. And that's wild to me that so early on you recognized that and you were changing what you wrote, you know, for that external reader. And that's one of the hardest push and pulls of being a writer is what do I want to write? And then what does the reader want?
Yes, yes. And I know that it's not a diary entry because it's sort of, I've done some sort of frame around it with my fingers.
We'll put the picture on.
As flower, sort of, it looks like
those fingers are so good.
Or something.
But
what I detect in this is I think I'm aware that my mum's going to read it, but I am striving, which I think is something I'm still trying to do. I am striving for candor. I am striving for honesty, because I could have been like, my mum's so great.
Right.
Like, I love her and she's amazing.
But you wouldn't betray yourself that way.
But I think somehow I'm trying to like think of her, but also I'm trying to be honest because I'm saying like she's not like everyone else. And so I kind of cherish that as a proto or embryonic sign I'm striving for something honest.
Yeah, that seems like a big first step, just to sort of write something that acknowledges that, even if, you know, that does,
I wonder if my mum had... I'm sure she actually sent this to me.
Yeah, right. So she has read it.
I wonder if she just would have smiled and been like, oh, that's... she's working through some stuff.
Well, she's working through it.
And she must
especially with the money part,
She must have been able to tell, too. And, you know, all these other women around, I'm sure that you had a certain kind of affect or something that... Yeah. I mean, she probably could tell in some way that you were drawn to them. And I bet she knew a little bit, don't you think, of what was going on, maybe? And...
Yeah, I think so.
But probably just was very confident in herself.
Yes, yes. Yeah. She knew what she wanted, yeah.
The money part is so interesting, too. You said that you are also like, a penny pincher. Mm-hmm. And I am, too, and it took me a really long time. It actually took me until the pandemic to realize that the voice in my head telling me like to reuse the coffee or to save the pennies or whatever was my grandmother's voice from the Depression era. Mm. And like, I don't, when you were reading the money part, it was so obsessive, just kept going like where the amounts were, how much was each amount. And I do like the idea that maybe you were also pulling through some things that subconsciously you didn't know, you know?
Yeah, I think I'm still really obsessed with what's in my bank account.
Oh, yeah.
I could probably tell you, because I looked this morning, how, I mean, I'm also sort of, you know, working out the exchange rate. But and I only recently as well realized or heard about this thing called scarcity mentality. And a friend, Bridget, was telling me, she's got Irish descendants, that, scarcity mentality going back very strongly dynastically through potato famines and things in Ireland. And I, reading this, such an archive and an inventory, it's meant to be about my mum, and then suddenly it becomes a cartographic map of where all my money is. And bear in mind, I'm like 7 or 8.
No, it was really, it is interesting that it went that way at all, sort of.
And why?
Yeah.
Well, and the can, you talk about candor, the moment, and you, the way you read it was really wonderful too, where it's, I have this much money that came from my grandfather who died, period, from his will. Period. Like the ability even at that age to know those things and to not present it with emotion, like you are just being like you're listing the facts, which also seems suggestive of like the for lack of a better way of describing it, the stiff upper lip idea, which is like, I'm going to say what's happening and I'm going to keep moving. And I find that fascinating also because something we've been hearing in a lot of these interviews is we read old work and we think about family, we think about environments, and then we look at what we end up producing. And as you're talking about your mom and you're talking about the way that in particular women are looked at, are thought that they need to act or ways that in acting against that in any way, they're being judged in some capacity. That is a central element to a lot of your work as well. And so it seems like your mother, even in the way that she was in the world, seemed to clearly instill some of those ideas that you are continuing to explore to this day.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that. But also that the style in which I'm writing here seems in some ways quite similar to my new style. Whereas when I was a teenager, I got very into language.
And
I was like, give me a thesaurus and I'll use every single one of those synonyms. And but whereas here, it's really quite plain and quite interestingly written and a lot of show don't tell.
So when you talk about your new style, by that, do you mean also the style that this newest collection of stories is written in? Or a different new style?
So for my first three novels, I would describe them as being written in a sort of high literary British establishment style, which is that everything is sort of polished and elegant and sort of familiar, I think, to many. And maybe because they were historical, it, you know, it was written in a language that was sort of the period, or it didn't have a place in time. Or it felt ahistorical, achronological, something like that. And then during the first lockdown in the UK, I didn't know what to do because I couldn't get to an archive. The idea of writing historical fiction, like doing research and doing writing, and I had a one-year-old and a five-year-old, and I was like, this is not going to work. And I was reading Jenny Zhang's collection of short stories, and they're just like deliciously repugnant and filthy and obscene and trash talk, and I was like, I didn't know you could write.
The first time I heard her read, I didn't know you could either.
Jenny was one of the writers who read at camp to the high school students. And I remember when she read, that's where it all began.
Yeah.
The students were like, you can do anything.
You can do anything.
I didn't know you're allowed to put that much bodily fluid on a page. And I read it and I was just like, this is tremendously exciting.
This is not a list of my bank accounts.
But I was like, and that's, it was, I think you're allowed like one or two light bulb moments in your life.
Oh, of course.
And that was one for me.
Amazing.
I was like, I am gonna write how I talk.
No, I mean, and that's one of the things where when I began reading this collection, and I'm only three stories in, you really notice. That's one of the great attractions I think about it, is just that the style is very, it's sort of punchy. It's the sentences aren't really long and sort of burnished, but it's just beautifully written, and it's really, it has a lot of energy, and it's just I mean, it's really wonderful.
It was interesting because I did a festival once and somebody said to me, "You're really funny. Why don't you write funny scenes or literature?" And I was like, "Oh, I don't know. I've just, you know." Always, you know, I think that word burnish is actually really accurate and helpful, because it's like there's a sort of glow that you can confect in a way once you become a seasoned writer, you've done it enough. And then suddenly when I read Jenny Zhang, I was like, oh, I just want it to all be about the voice, just about like me talking to you and telling you a funny anecdote of like, isn't this funny when I threw this missile at a counselor, at a therapist. Then I suddenly became really enchanted with the idea of voice. And so there was a sort of break or rupture in my writing career. And now I'm here and I'm wanting to write just contemporary and just in my voice.
Yeah. I remember reading about George Saunders having a moment like that really early on, where he was writing some things that were kind of serious and traditional, and his wife noticed, or his girlfriend at the time noticed, all these sort of funny little drawings and notes he'd been leaving around, and she was like, "Now these are genuinely entertaining.
These
are really funny."
Sometimes it takes someone on the outside to say, look, you may be like brushing this off, but this is where the gold is.
Yes.
So I want to get back to what you're writing now. So, okay, so you've written this piece when you're young, then you and your family move, writing was a part of your life, and then you sort of stepped away from it for a little bit. You had this great English teacher. In the way I understood you describe it a minute ago, so then you went to university. You did not study writing at university?
No.
So you then graduate, and you are working in publishing, and then you make a decision at that point to be a writer.
Yeah, so I went to Cambridge University, and it was 2001. It was just very traditional English literature degree with no creative writing whatsoever. So it went dormant, and then I worked in publishing. I worked for a children's books publisher, and I guess I was writing throughout that, maybe short stories failing badly at them. But I sent in a story to the MA program at UEA, which is a sort of IRA equivalent in Europe. And I had my interview with my now friend, Andrew Cowan, and he saw something in it. Yeah. But it was unformed and unschooled. And he said, "We would like you to take a year out to live and write." That sentence. I'll never forget it.
Wow.
And I was like, oh.
You mean he was offering you a year?
He said, "You can come and do the course in a year."
Oh, I see. Okay.
"We want you to delay.
Oh,
and
cool.
We want you to write more."
Oh, cool.
So basically saying, before you come here.
An apprenticeship.
Yeah. We want you just to be in the world and then come here.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
So I just, and I still do, because he's now my mentor, my friend, and my first editor, my first reader. We both live in Norwich. And I moved to Paris and wrote a first draft of The Godless Boys.
Nice.
Nice dream.
Yeah, so I became a nanny. So I looked after the kids in the mornings, and then I picked them up from school, and I was like a fake mom. And I lived in Hemingway. I lived in a little apartment on the seventh floor in the center of Paris, and it was terribly lonely and actually kind of an awful year. It was miserable, but I did get my work done.
How did you get it? When did you write? Did you write like
while the kids were at school?
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
So you had like a win. You knew I've only got these hours.
Yeah, that's the best way to do it.
Yeah,
like.
But I look back and I'm like, oh, I had tons of time.
Right.
Now I have like, oh, here's your hour. in the morning.
Yeah. Exactly.
Right.
As you get more time, as the kids, my kid's 15 now, and it's so strange. I was so hungry for that time at the younger ages, and then all of a sudden there's so much time, and you really don't remember what you used to do with it. Like, I'll be like, I can write, but it's not under pressure of bedtime. And then you're like, I've changed.
Yeah. I mean, my pie is completely full.
Yeah.
Well, so that's another thing I was curious about. So you come from that Parisian experience, then you go to school, then at some point you also start teaching, and then eventually you're in this dream space where now you are a teacher. You're also an active participant in the writing community. You're finding the success. And you're also giving yourself space, which you just explained to us, to like try new things and be writing in different ways.
Cool.
Along the way, when you started into the sort of graduate school space, were there writers that, as you were trying to learn during those years, that you came to and you were like, oh, this is something? Because I'm just curious, when you were in school, you were studying literature. Were there other writers that you came to later that really helped you form that writing base that you were trying to grow?
I think when I was writing my more sort of historical novels, there were names that you would have heard of. So Kazuo Ishiguro, Ian McEwan, and NWrite, a lot of sort of UEA grads, mm-hmm. actually. Mm-hmm. And they were my touchstones. Andrew Cowan as well, he was massive influence on me. Mm-hmm. And then with the later work, it's been more about short story writers. And I just completely, mm-hmm. because I had tried for 15 years to write short stories and just failed mm-hmm. all the time. And I was like, what am I not getting here? I'm really, there's something I'm just fundamentally not understanding, because I was grafting all of my skills from novel writing to the short story. And I was like, okay, I know I can create characters. I know I can create problematic tension and I can do descriptions, but something about this is failing. And I realized, through Jenny Zhang, and then I just kind of read short stories for 5 years, was that I'm not understanding the form. And so, the form was like, and then once I got that, I started to have success with short stories, but it took me 15 years three novels to get there.
Well, it takes what it takes.
Yeah, it really does. Yeah.
So just out of curiosity, the form, is there anything particular or more specific that you can say about that? Like, was there, because I've struggled for years to write stories. I don't think I've ever written one. They're so hard to do. Mm. So was there anything particular for you that you felt like you needed to learn about the form that sort of helped you to go forward?
Yeah, I think it's something that I talk about with my MA students.
Okay.
And it's quite difficult to articulate without it sounding really simple and sort of reductive. But you have to know what the story is about. Whereas I think when you're writing a novel, you can flail around generously in this very baggy monster, and you will generate and you'll get somewhere. I think with the story, if you know what the story is about, then you know what the question is at the beginning. Mm. And to me, like a classic or a sort of classically designed story, it does start with this essential question. Mm. And from that question, it launches itself. And then I think the difficulty with the ending is that the ending then in some ways must answer that question, even if it decides to leave it unresolved. But what I've realized, like when I judge competitions, short story competitions, is that, a lot of people, they start on like page 7. And I'm like, you are not writing a novel, mister. Yeah. Like, you need to start this there. And a lot of people don't understand the sensitive form of the short story, which is this launch from this essential tension or paradox. And once you kind of get that, you'll get your through line, then you'll have, four or five scenes with some summary, and that's kind of it. Mm. but it's that knowing what you're writing about, which is extremely difficult.
Yeah, no, that was... If I ever try to write a story again, I'm going to come back and listen to that.
It won't help you, though.
Oh, I think it might. I think it was.
I remember talking with Grace Paley when I was up in Vermont, and a very lauded short story writer. And she was telling me about Danny and I both are poets, or try to be. And she was talking about, because to me, the short story seems like a cinch and the novel seems impossible, but that's because I'm coming from a poetry standpoint where you're already condensing so much. And she said that she started writing poetry and it was making her short stories easier to write and better. And I wonder if you see a connection between those.
I think absolutely. I think the short story shares an adjacent boundary with the poem, not with the novel, because it is, you have to hit your marks. You have to, it is a shape and a business that is obsessed with its own form and its own sort of teleological inevitability, that it's always about the ending, right? Like, I remember one teacher said to me, like, when you're reading a novel, you know where it ends because it's at the back cover.
Yeah.
Whereas the short story, you're always nervous that it's just about to end. So it's a form that is obsessed with its endingness.
Yeah, I've never thought about that.
That's you don't know if it's you can cheat. But there is something, I think, if you think about a really formal poem like a sonnet and you think about a short story, there is a sort of shapefulness that, like, if somebody said, teach me the form of a novel, I'd be like, I can't say anything. It could be, you could do anything. Yeah. So I think there is more through traffic between those two forms.
And speaking of that, I am curious about your new collection. So when you are seeing those forms or the form of the story and seeing those through lines, what was it like for you to write these stories and then put them in a collection where they can sort of speak to one another? Did you find, compared to a novel, did you find that process interesting? Was it hard to decide how you would order them? Because as someone who's just fascinated by that book, it's so good. I found not only the ways that they were connected in elements of their subject and elements of even just, as Stephen was pointing out, just the way that they're written and their sentence structure, I just found that even as characters moved between stories and these were of different worlds, it felt like of one like heartbeat and it just felt completely connected. And so I was curious if you found the process of structuring the book difficult, easy once you had the stories. Did you find it interesting given how putting story X next to story Y would bring out an interesting idea?
Yeah, I think I'm going to be disappointing in my answer because it was a case of sort of like separating or ventilating the book so that like the themes didn't abut each other too much. I also felt though in retrospect I'm not sure if this is an accurate worry, but. Because I described the book as a collection of short stories about charmingly toxic mothers. And then when I've talked to readers, they're like, I don't find them toxic. they live out fantasies of cruelty that we entertain. They sort of burn things to the ground in a way that I think a lot of mothers would like to. Fantasies of abandonment or cruelty or self... serving oneself first, and that's why it was so interesting. A lot of readers said, oh, yeah, I don't find them toxic, and I was like, oh yeah, they're actually in some ways they are maybe more familiar to a reader. So I think when I was putting them together there was a slight anxiety that maybe an autobiographical anxiety that the women were quite negative, and I maybe didn't want to be read as the original inspirational source for the women, and I sort of wanted to air them out. I think the worst woman is in Dracula at the movies, where she sort of could be done for some Me Too crimes. She's a female film director, and she's sort of weaponizing her young actress's trauma. And exploiting it. And I think that, like, I was nervous, I guess, that people were going to see a concentration of cruelty. But now when I look back on it, I actually don't think they're that bad. So I was worried somehow about the collection being too concentratedly bad or too concentratedly negative. And now when I look back on it, I think... maybe I actually could have dialed that up even more. Ooh. Like maybe the missile she could have thrown at the therapist would have, you know, caused some real damage. So it's really interesting to think that like where your own nerves or your own anxieties or worries are somewhat misplaced actually. But I'm pleased with how the collection sits and coheres, and then it has this sort of like leap into fantasy at the end, which was directly inspired by Wells Towers' Everything Ravaged, Everything Burned, because I was like, I didn't know you could write eight stories of realist naturalism and then sort of end with a story of sort of sophomores speaking in an American vernacular of the present rampaging through Viking Europe. So I was like, I'm going to have a story about a group of mums on a dinosaur ranch on a reality TV show. The collection sort of cohered very slowly over the course of the 3 years I think I was writing it.
I love how you talk about giving the, how did you put it, giving the stories a space to breathe, or you said it, in a much
ventilate.
Ventilate.
Yeah, that was a good word.
So
pretentious verb alert.
And this makes me think of like visual artistic composition. And, you know, I draw as well as write. And when I'm putting together poetry collections, I am thinking about a composition that's not visual, but is something like that, so that each piece, its placement, just in the same way you'd place a shape or a color next to another shape or color, like that also affects each piece. Mm. And sometimes I get like way too obsessed with the overwhelming amount of possibilities of which piece comes before, which piece comes after. But I really like that that does seem like almost a visual artist sensibility that you have there. And I'm sure that it comes through. So cool. Thanks. So this is one of my favorite questions. This person who is 8 or 9 writing this piece, if we were to go back in time, you, how you are now, bring your books with you, all your published books, and you said to her, like, look, we did it. Like, we're a writer.
This is how it turns out.
Yeah. Well, like, what do you think? Like,
I think she'd be completely thrilled.
Oh, good.
But also probably surprised, because I don't think there was a, like, it wasn't inevitable that I was going to be a writer. It wasn't like my heart's passion. I kind of wanted to be a historian. I don't know if that's a profession you can actually, like, aspire to, but it probably explains the historical novels. It was only later, I think, in my 20s that it all sort of coalesced where I thought, I think I want to do this. But I would be thrilled. But also, you know, I thought it was well within my remit that I could do.
Oh, all right. That's awesome.
I was, maybe going back to my mum, she had instilled in me a sense of like
confidence.
You can, you're like, you're smart and you could do something like that.
I love that.
And, you know, maybe she'd be thrilled and she'd be like, good, that's what I was expecting of you.
Wow. So cool. I love that. Yeah. One last question we also like to ask is, so can you talk at all about maybe what you're working on now?
Yeah, I mean, I'm in a bit of a, I'm struggling a bit right now, to be honest. I was writing a novel, and then in this way that like midlife happens to you sometimes, like it just became, I don't know, I mean, I do know why I moved house. I sold my house and I moved house, which I shan't do for another 10 years. And it's just been on ice for like 5 months, which is the longest I've ever left something. And so I'm terribly anxious every day about whether when I come back to it, it's going to be like some used flannel that I'll be like, oh, that needs to go on the wash and I never want to see it again. Or I do want to come back to it, and I do read it. It's about a woman who discovers that a deepfake video has been made of her. Oh. And then it's sort of about she's losing her identity at the same time that she's sort of seeing multiples of herself everywhere. Mm-hmm. So it's an idea I'm fascinated by, and I've increasingly been reading theory, and I'm interested in the uncanny and the way that she's sort of thinking about, maybe it's about motherhood and about loss of identity. And I split with my partner last year, so there's sort of, I came into this new identity, or I'm coming through mm-hmm. it. Mm-hmm. But what I think is really interesting, and something that we don't talk about as writers, is what do we do with like periods of absence away from our work and away from our practice? How do we get back there?
What did Nam say? We had Namley on the show, and
we got a great answer.
He had a great answer, which is he said he's in the gathering phase.
Yeah, we like.
So
that.
You're in the gathering phase.
But I suppose I was in the writing phase, and now I'm on the icy phase because I haven't.
Just another gathering.
But
phase.
You're gathering because you're reading theory, you're thinking about it. The thing that I love, I mean, I love Nam as a human, but I also love about this idea is it has reminded me that if I'm watching a video on TikTok or I'm reading something in the Times, actually that's informing the things that I'm going to be writing about. And so a little bit, it's like the am writing idea. It's like, oh, I'm technically writing because I'm thinking, but trying to remember that the gathering part of it is huge, because that one of those things you read or one of those pieces of theory is going to be the thing that clicks you back in.
So what does Nam Lee say about going from gathering to writing? How do I do that?
Nam Lee says Nam Lee says he still hasn't finished his novel.
Exactly.
Or Nam, you know, goes from being short story writers
to playing poker
and then writing a book of poems. So it's also like giving yourself space to like
evolve or
to write more stories while you're thinking.
Right,
of the
novel. That's the question. That's such a hard question. How to break? I don't like the phrase writer's block. I don't think it exists. I mean, I've gone years without writing, and then suddenly something comes. But it could be like I have lists of. Do I buy myself a new notebook? Mm. Do I, you know, at one point I was like, I'm going to install Scrivener, this like program on my computer that will help me write. And like, for me, I need like a dopamine dump, like some sort of new object or whatever to like jump back into a project. And sometimes that doesn't work. Mm. But I've found that I can't like force that switch to happen, and that's so upsetting because I love being in control of things. I mean, that we all do. We're writers, you know. Like, why is this the one story I can't control? Is me starting to write again, right?
My new house. I've got, for the first time in my life at 42, I've got an office with a desk where I can work, and I just stand at the precipice of the and I think, I'm never going in.
No.
And I've been working at the kitchen
table. We need to send you home with a bunch of like cool pens from RSVP and like paper. Yeah. We need to send you home with like little like.
What you do is you get
this
back.
Actually happening. This sounds great.
Yeah. Or just go back to England when you're ready. Just call. We'll do a Zoom and we'll just talk you right across the.
Lauren,
across
help
the
me. Yes, I'll be like, go to the stationery store.
Naomi, it's been such a pleasure not only to have you on the show but to have you here in Iowa City.
Thank you.
We're lucky to have you on campus. We look forward to many more partnerships and collaborations in the future.
Yeah, it's been fantastic.
Your visit here in Iowa
Thank
City.
You.
Thanks,
Cheers.
Naomi.
Support for this podcast comes from the University of Iowa, the Magid Center for Writing, the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences, and the Graduate College. We'd like to thank the Center for Language and Culture Learning for use of their podcast studio. Sad Me of the Past is part of the Writing University Podcast Network at the University of Iowa. This network includes podcasts from creative writing programs and departments all across our campus. Visit writinguniversity.org/podcasts to see our full list of offerings, including Writing Matters, The 11th Hour, Origins, The Short Coat, and more.